Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. My name is Joe Tooman, Professor of Political and Legal Communications at San Francisco State University and also Political Analyst for CBS 5 Television in San Francisco. Today I'll be your moderator for this program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation, and we're very appreciative of that. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Jeffrey Frank, a former senior editor of The New Yorker from 1995 through 2009, and author of several novels, by the way, as well, including the Washington Trilogy, with great books, The Columnist, Bad Publicity, I think also in Trudy Hoopdale. And today, going back to his nonfiction news-type roots, also the author of a new book, which will very quickly be featured, I think, on the front page of the New York Times book review, a review of books, this coming Sunday. And the book is called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Please join me in welcoming Jeffrey Frank.
Thank you very much. I'm really honored to be here, and it's a special for me because of the history of this place with my subjects. Both Richard Nixon and Eisenhower gave speeches here. People asked me sort of what drew me to this subject, and it was just absolutely irresistible on several levels. One was the fact that these two characters were there's no one like them. Particularly Eisenhower, he was the man. He had led the Allied armies to defeat the Nazis in Europe. He had led the Allied expeditionary force in the invasion of Normandy. He was one of only 4 or 5-star generals. We don't have 5-star generals anymore, and he was such a national hero back then that both parties wanted him to run for president. The Democrats were after him. Jimmy Roosevelt, FDR's son, had tried to get him to run, and the Republicans wanted him. And it got to the point that one senator said to him, you could run with both parties, and we could just have different vice presidents on the ticket. And Eisenhower was actually fairly naive about politics. He thought it was a fairly good idea, but that wasn't going to happen. And he couldn't declare himself. He claimed that he really wasn't interested in politics. I think there was always some lingering ambition in him for that. As soon as it was sort of brought up, and the first time it was actually brought up was in a conversation with Harry Truman after the Potsdam Conference in 1945. And Truman turned to him. This was very soon after Roosevelt had died. And said, General Eisenhower, I'll do anything I can to help you, including getting you the presidency. So this had already been planted with him, and he was an amazing figure and a true national hero of the kind. We simply don't have anyone like him. I keep thinking of a way to compare him, and we have no one like him today. Nixon, by contrast, was a 39-year-old California senator, and he had made his reputation as a congressman. For being a very sort of skilled red hunter, but he wasn't just an anti-communist fanatic or anything. He had a larger view. He was an internationalist in a time when parts of his party were rather isolationist. Nixon supported the Marshall Plan, and he had many things sort of going for him in terms of appealing to Eisenhower. The first time they met was in 1950, not very far from here at the Bohemian Grove. Eisenhower was invited because in 1950 he was the president of Columbia University, and he had been chief of staff after the war. Then he became this. Then he went. Then Truman sent him to Europe to help set up NATO. Nixon was about to begin his worst and nastiest campaign against Helen Gahagan Douglas. It was the campaign that probably people who really turned against him, that's the one they never forgave and never forgot. The Democrats. It was the first campaign where he really used the red issue, which he had done a little bit in 1946 when he ran for Congress. And, of course, he had made his reputation by going after Alger Hiss when he was a member of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. But the Helen Douglas campaign was the meanest he ever ran. And at one point he said, she's pink right down to her underwear. He was getting coaching from a man named Murray Chotiner, who was sort of the Karl Rove of his day. Chotiner believed that one of the ways to win a campaign, and he gave courses of this to his party, is to deflate your opposition. And Nixon, after this campaign, I talked to a woman who had worked in his staff in Washington. I met her about a month before she died. She was 98 years old, Dorothy Cox Donnelly, and she said, "Yeah, we thought it was a really sordid campaign too, and they everyone knew it." But Nixon won with 600,000 votes. The only one who did better that year was Earl Warren. And anyway, Nixon was also invited to the Bohemian Grove that summer. Herbert Hoover, the former president, loved the Grove. He called it the greatest men's party on earth. And so you can see this. I found a picture at the Hoover Institution, and there's Hoover at the head of the table. Everyone called him the chief. Ike is to his right, and three places down on his left is Nixon. That was their first meeting. And they met about a year later when Nixon was visiting France as part to visit the World Health Organization, and he stopped by to see Eisenhower. And by that time, Nixon knew Eisenhower had a future in the party. But then the next time they really met was in 1952 at the Republican National Convention. The Ohio Senator Robert Taft probably had more delegates when they went in, but Eisenhower was probably destined to win. He had a very strong team, a very aggressive team, sort of working to get the nomination. Tom Dewey, the former governor of New York, Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., who was the senator of Massachusetts, and others were sort of helping him with his floor fights. And Eisenhower got the nomination, and then came time to choose a vice president. Nixon was being mentioned by then. But Eisenhower didn't even know that it was up to the presidential candidate to make this choice. And so he was asked later about it by a Times report, by James Reston, who was a Times reporter in Washington, later became a columnist. And Eisenhower said, yeah, there was a meeting and with my advisors, and there were six or seven names on the list, and he was on the list. And so they were together. They had a lot going for them for this to work. As I say, Nixon was 39, Eisenhower was 62, and he was an old 62. He had smoked three packs a day. He'd stopped by then. The war really wore him down. He had digestive problems and so on. And Nixon was 39 years old and full of energy. What he had going for him was he was a red hunter, he was a westerner, and he could really appeal to the base of his party. So that was the team. And they started off with one of their slogans was let's clean house with Ike and Dick. And that slogan referred to the scandals. There were huge scandals in Washington, and there were Harry Truman scandals. Harry Truman was not personally tainted by any of this, but well, even though his wife accepted a deep freeze apparently, but as they said, it broke very quickly, so it doesn't really count. But the people around Truman. There were mink coats being given out, and there were kickbacks on government contracts. So it was a real sort of smell in the air. So the slogan, this idea, let's clean house, was a good slogan. And Eisenhower and Nixon met in Fraser, Colorado, one of Eisenhower's favorite spots, where Eisenhower tried to teach him fly fishing. I have the URL in the book where you can look up and see a video of Nixon attempting to do this and catching a hook on his jacket. And Eisenhower also was very fond of bridge, which Nixon never learned, and he was fond of golf, which Nixon really studied. And I talked to a man who caddied for him in 1953, and he really learned this game. Anyway, then all hell broke loose. In September, about two months after the convention, the New York Post ran a story with a big headline that said, Nixon's secret fund, and I'm sure you must know the story of the whole Checkers episode. But it really floored both Eisenhower and Nixon. Eisenhower wanted him off the ticket. Simple as that. But one of Eisenhower's weaknesses, and Nixon sensed it pretty quickly, was he really couldn't confront anyone directly. He couldn't confront Patton during the war. When he wanted to have him do something else, he had someone else tell him. Eisenhower didn't even talk to Nixon for a while. There were a couple of days of a real silent treatment. It was finally decided that Nixon had to explain the so-called secret fund, which actually wasn't all that secret. He had admitted it to others. It was about $18,000, and he went on television, gave the speech, and ended with a famous statement about. Here's how much our mortgages are. This is what our car is worth, our house is worth, and then he said, and someone sent a black and white cocker spaniel to us, and my daughter Tricia named it Checkers, and by gosh, we're going to keep it. And that was the sort of famous line. But what really happened during that speech was he defied Eisenhower. Eisenhower had asked Dewey to call him, and Dewey had called Nixon and said, Dick, I hate to tell you this, but when you finish your speech, we want you to resign from the ticket. And Nixon is speechless. I thought I was going to be able to sort of clear myself. And then Dewey said, and furthermore, we think it might be a really good idea if you resign from the Senate while you're at it, and then you could run and really be a hero when you came back. And Nixon said, there are various versions of what he said, but basically wait and see what I'm going to do. If you want to see how politics is played, you'll see it. And Nixon triumphed. He not only gave the speech he intended to give, but he ended up by saying, write to the Republican National Committee, tell them how you feel, which made Eisenhower feel how, you know, he basically undercut Eisenhower. And people picked that up. One of the most influential columnists of the day, Walter Lippmann, just said, you know, Eisenhower was totally undercut by Nixon. But Nixon won. And it was the first of, there was the first sort of confrontation, and it was a really big deal. I mean, people laugh at it, and if you look at the speech today, it looks sort of funny and maudlin, but in 1952 on a little black and white television following the Milton Berle show, it was pretty effective, and you know, thousands and thousands of people, I think Nixon, and even Mamie Eisenhower was said to have cried, and So Nixon reached out, but years, he wrote later on, this was a scar that never healed, and his wife Pat never got over it. She hated politics after that. And every year, Julie Nixon said that every year on the anniversary of the speech, the Checkers speech, her father would turn around and say, you know what today is? And he never got over it. He became a fairly active vice president. Eisenhower did him a huge favor of sending him around the world in 1953. Eisenhower was very aware that Harry Truman had no idea what was going on when Roosevelt died, and he was very... And even though he wasn't enormously fond of Nixon, he took that responsibility seriously. That if he died, Nixon would be able to would at least know what was going on. Nixon was at the cabinet meetings, the legislative leaders meetings, the National Security Council meetings, and he sent him on a trip all through Asia in '53. And Nixon had a chance to meet all these leaders he'd never met before, and he began to sort of get up to speed. And it was a real favor. They never were close socially. Eisenhower never had him into the living quarters and so on. And Nixon was always slightly in awe of Eisenhower. He never really got over that. He really always kind of needed Eisenhower's approval. The big change in their relationship probably happened in 1955 when Eisenhower had a major heart attack. People at the time didn't even realize how serious it was, but there have been books written about it since that, you know, Eisenhower was in very critical condition for a while. And Nixon and, you know, and the cabinet was pretty panicky. John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, who had an uncle who had been a Secretary of State when Woodrow Wilson had his incapacitating stroke, wanted research done. What do you do if the president can't function and so on? And Nixon stepped up and stepped in and did it. With people praised him. He wasn't assertive and. But he basically wanted to assure people the government was going on, and he said, "My role, I am the vice president. I'm not the acting president," and so on. And that was a moment when Dulles and Nixon actually became close, and Dulles began to sort of mentor him. I think it made things odd for Eisenhower. And in 1956, when Eisenhower had to run again, Nixon, in the first place, Eisenhower didn't make clear whether he was going to run or not for a while. People said he couldn't possibly, after this heart attack, he was 65 years old, he couldn't possibly run again, but of course he did run again. And then he basically told Nixon, well, I think you should do something else, Dick. He offered him a cabinet job. He offered him Secretary of Defense and some other job, and Nixon just thought, here it goes again. And this time it didn't end right away like the Checkers incident did. It went on for months. These conversations began in January, and Nixon knew that Eisenhower, even if he was serious, the whole world would think he'd been dumped, and Nixon did not want to be dumped. It would be the end of his career. And also because people now think of the vice president as an heir to the presidency, but it sure wasn't the case then. I mean, no one, vice presidents were sort of doofuses. FDR certainly didn't think Henry Wallace or John Ansel Garner and Harry Truman were capable of being president. He didn't tell them anything. So that had changed, And so Nixon was being considered a presidential candidate, and right after the heart attack, you know, people like papers like the New York Times were saying it's a man of his young years is being regarded as an heir to the presidency for the first time, and that made it difficult not only for his competitors in the party, but of course all the Democrats who still hated him. Nixon, though, was getting very good press by now. You know, you always think of Nixon being sort of attacked by the press, but Nixon was getting very good reviews. His trip to Asia was applauded by everyone. The New York Times spoke of this big, friendly American who liked the natives, and they seemed to like him. There was a whole view of Nixon that we sort of lost. Anyway, Eisenhower finally, Nixon basically outweighed him on this. Eisenhower couldn't, even though Eisenhower told the Republican National Committee chairman, tell Dick he's done for, a man named Leonard Hall, and he said, be very, very gentle, but he just couldn't pull the trigger. And we know all this because Eisenhower's secretary, A woman named Ann Whitman was wonderful. She took down all these. She sat in all these meetings and kept very good notes. And you can sort of see them all in Abilene. And there's just so you really get a picture of what was being said. And there was even a moment when Eisenhower said to Nixon, "Look, Nick, we're going to be having some meetings about the election, and you'll understand why we can't have you because you're going to be one of the subjects of discussion." And Nixon just suffered. He called it a moment of agonizing uncertainty. And then just after he was finally back on the ticket. There was another. Eisenhower got sick again. A man named Harold Stassen began a campaign to get Nixon off the ticket and replaced by the governor of Massachusetts. And Eisenhower certainly went along with this. He could have stopped it in a second, and he didn't stop it. Nixon certainly knew that too. But they won. They won in 56 by a landslide. Nixon had tenure, and they were going forward. And even though he had tenure, he still had a win Ike's approval. And there were more crises to come. In 1957. While Eisenhower was facing enormous strain, the Little Rock integration crisis and Sputnik, he had a stroke, and for a couple of days, no one even knew whether he'd be able to function. He lost the power of speech for a day. He couldn't remember words like thermostat. He would mix up ceiling and floor, and then everyone was completely terrified this time that it was all over. But Eisenhower bounced back, and he went to a NATO meeting two and a half weeks later. Nixon, meanwhile, was taking on the civil rights portfolio of the administration. Dulles had sent him to the Gold Coast, which became Ghana for their independence ceremonies, and that's where he met Martin Luther King Jr. And they began they hit it off. And King had been trying to see Nixon anyway, and they hit it off. And Nixon said, "Come meet me in Washington. We'll come to my office." And they had a long session together. They wrote to each other. They stayed in touch. King was very, 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 very impressed by Nixon. And Nixon, in the summer of 57, a couple of months after the trip, the administration supported what at the time was a landmark civil rights bill. And Nixon took the administration's view. Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson are given credit for getting the bill passed, and of course they did because they were in Congress. But the bill was a weaker bill than the administration wanted. There was a particular provision, the voting rights section of the bill, and this gets really complicated, but basically Johnson was playing all kinds of, by this time he saw himself running for president. He had to appeal to the northern liberal Democrats, and also, but he didn't want to lose the southern conservatives like Richard Russell. And the voting rights section if any violation of voting rights would then be subject to a jury trial, and everyone knew this was ridiculous. A jury trial of the South on a voting rights thing was like an instant nullification. And thanks to the administration, the Eisenhower administration, and Nixon carrying it through, they made it a slightly stronger bill, and it said that a judge could impose a fine and some jail time for any violation of this voting rights thing. And Nixon got huge thanks from Dr. King, from Jackie Robinson, who was actually a friend of his and had been a supporter and a friend of his since the 1952 convention, when Nixon saw him in the corridor and said, I remember when you were playing football at UCLA. I'll never forget a play you made, and that really impressed Jackie Robinson. And it was Nixon was a real sports fan. So and then 1960 began to approach, and probably the most devastating thing Eisenhower ever said about him was in the in late summer of 1960. Someone had asked Eisenhower. By this time Nixon was speaking of the Eisenhower Nixon administration, which really annoyed Eisenhower because someone asked him, "Well, can you think of one major contribution that Vice President Nixon has made to your administration?" And Eisenhower said, "If you give me a week, I might think of one." It was devastating to Nixon. Eisenhower claimed he didn't mean it; it came out wrong. He was being facetious, but it never went away. And Kennedy used it against him in the campaign. The reporters, of course, who were all in love with Kennedy, managed to repeat it. And it was devastating. The most devastating thing of all for Nixon, by the way, was an act of cowardice. When Dr. King was arrested on a totally trumped-up charge and put in a paddy wagon and chains to be taken to Reeseville Prison in Georgia, Coretta Scott King called both campaigns, the Kennedy campaign and the Nixon campaign, and said, "Would you please help get him out?" There was the violence against African Americans in the South in Georgia at that time was horrible, and she really thought he was going to be killed. And the Kennedy people stepped up, and Nixon told his advisors that would just be grandstanding to interfere with the legal process. And King, that was it. King later said he had we were in touch. I thought we were friends, and he was. It showed a real moral lapse. And if Nixon had done it, Kennedy was sent, by the way, the Kennedy people sent out a campaign flyer that said, no comment, Nixon versus the candidate with a heart. And if Nixon had carried the black vote, and he, by the way, he still got 32% of the black vote, unlike today when Republicans get like 2% of the black vote. But he would have won. He would have won. Probably would have won at least two more states, and everything would have changed. And so there was payback for him for not stepping up. I should just say that after that he lost. I think it was the most traumatic thing that ever happened to him, losing that. He thought he was cheated. He thought it was stolen from him. He couldn't believe how ruthless the Kennedys were. Because he had been friends with Jack Kennedy. He'd gone to their wedding. He had sponsored Kennedy's membership in the Burning Hill Country Club. After Nixon's, I mentioned the really vicious campaign against Helen Douglas, Kennedy spoke to some Harvard students after that and said, I'm really glad that Mrs. Douglas lost. She would have been really horrible to work with in the Senate. But until this campaign, there was more. They really had a real bond. And Jackie Kennedy thanked Nixon for helping her husband keep his place when he was very ill, and the Senate was reorganized, and Nixon was vice president. And then in 1960, that was over. I mean, the competition was so fierce and so intense. And of course, they could never be friends again. And Nixon felt the election was stolen by the Kennedys. That Illinois and Texas together could have been his without their conniving. So. And that was, I think that probably explains a lot of his, I mean, he was a tormented person to begin with in many ways, but I think this really embittered him, because he really felt something was taken from him that he deserved. So have I spoken? I'll happily go on forever, but I want to give you a chance. So let me know what I should do. Joe, what do you think? I could mention, you know, he ran for governor, you know, practiced law and became president, but you know that. And their two families became one family toward the end, too. I haven't even mentioned that.
So. Okay, well, thank you. Our thanks to Jeffrey Frank, former senior editor of The New Yorker and author of the new book, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage, for his comments. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions, so let's begin. I've been trying to pull these together. As those of you who are joining us today, if you've been here before, you know we can't always ask all the questions that come in, because sometimes there are more of you that have questions than there is time to answer. But I think we'll try and get to most of these today. Jeffrey, because I'm asking the questions, I get to ask my question first. You mentioned his angst a moment ago. Yeah. And I think that most people who are old enough to remember Nixon as almost a Shakespearean kind of tragic, complicated, not boring, character. Well, he's not. He's interesting. He's not dull. We sense that most of his injuries were self-inflicted. And so my question to you, and you discuss some of this in the book, if you wouldn't mind expanding on it, what is your sense in this biographical look at him of the source of his anxiety, his paranoia, his insecurity? Where did this come from?
Yeah, I mean, I don't use any of those words. I mean, I think poor Dick Nixon has been so psychoanalyzed by so many people that I didn't want to do it. I think the worst offense against him was posthumous defense was a woman named Fawn Brody, who was trying to prove that Nixon and his friend B.B. Barroso were having a homosexual relationship. I would listen to her interviews when I went out to the Marriott Library in Salt Lake City, and she was a very bright woman, but every interview would end, so Mr. Nixon and Mr. Obama spent a lot of time together, didn't they? What were they? And of course, that was nonsense and so on. But I think all these things together sort of contributed to. I think losing the campaign contributed to it. I think there was a basic insecurity that even his law partners sensed when he moved to New York. They were actually amused by it in some cases. He was his awkwardness. They loved watching him. They loved watching him take a cigar, Fumble, watch it drop on the floor, cutting off the wrong end. I mean, he was not a very graceful person. But I think the root of the problem, I don't know what's going on, is that you really began to see it, and it was when he became president, and that was his downfall, not only because of what happened, because he wasn't really built for it. It was a combination of having great power and having great insecurity. That's a deadly combination in a leader, I think, and that's what. So it's less paranoia, but just I say this is intense insecurity, and I think it was not helped by the way Eisenhower treated him.
Okay, very good answer. Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll start with some of your questions from the audience today. You may have addressed this one already, but we've had a couple of versions of this. In your opinion, why exactly did Eisenhower choose Nixon over others to be his vice president?
Well, I should have made that clearer. I can't go so far as to say that Eisenhower chose him. He was chosen for the ticket by Eisenhower's advisors were pushing him. Tom Dewey, who was then the governor of New York, was very sort of in favor of Nixon. I don't want to start throwing all these names out at you, but well, Henry Cabot Lodge, Herbert Brownell, and so on. They just saw Nixon as a real strong counterweight to Eisenhower. He knew domestic politics. The communist issue was a big deal, and Nixon was identified with it in a way, but he wasn't Joe McCarthy. Eisenhower loathed Joe McCarthy, but Nixon played straight, so to speak, even though he used the issue to. And he was a Westerner, and he was young, so all the sort of demographics things going. Eisenhower, as I said, didn't realize that it was up to him to make the choice. He said, yeah, fine, basically.
So as a follow-up, is that to suggest that Eisenhower didn't have a predetermined favorite of his own?
Not at all. He didn't even realize that he was going to make the choice.
Okay.
Eisenhower hadn't lived in America. Eisenhower was born in Texas, grew up in Abilene, Kansas, went to West Point at age 19, and that was basically it. He was stationed all over the place, Panama. He was in the Philippines working under General MacArthur, who he did not like very much, and then the war, and so he really didn't know his country very well. What he did have was this great sense of how to use power, and a great sense of patience, and great instincts about war and peace, and that's why I think we were so lucky to have had him. But he really didn't know. Who could have been? He didn't really know who he could have picked anyway, because he didn't know anybody. He was in the army.
Then a follow-up question from a different one of our audience members about the second term, not the first term. What was Eisenhower's opinion of Nixon during a subsequent term, and did that indicate a change also for the Republican Party?
Yeah, I mean, I think Eisenhower always respected Nixon as someone who was loyal, who was intelligent, who was helpful. But people around, you have to remember, and I mentioned that he was a five-star general. We don't have those anymore. And he regarded basically everyone around him as staff. And Nixon was staff. He would issue an order, and it should be carried out. Nixon at one point said, I felt like a corporal going to see the commanding officer whenever he saw Eisenhower. And Eisenhower was kind of oblivious in many ways. One thing that always bothered me, just because I think of working for difficult bosses. I haven't had any, but I can imagine what they're going to be like. And Nixon's family, they finally got to have a family vacation in the summer of 1958. And Eisenhower, at this point, the first scandal of the administration. His chief of staff, a man named Sherman Adams, was being accused of being slightly on the take. And Eisenhower was being pressured to get rid of Sherman Adams because there was a midterm election coming up, and also. It was starting to stink a bit. So I called Nixon in West Virginia and said, Dick, I want you to come back to Washington and fire Sherman Adams, which, by the way, Eisenhower couldn't do it, and Nixon, it turned out, couldn't do it either. They actually handed it off to the Republican National Committee chairman at the time. Adams finally went, but it took several months to get rid of Adams.
I want to take us back for just a moment with another question to Checkers.
Yeah.
The Checkers speech you mentioned, 1952, I guess. In the book you wrote, I read that had come to Nixon.
Dewey was the one who made the call saying, "Dick, we hate to tell you this. Yeah,
we want you to resign at the end of the speech."
At the end of the speech, yeah.
Right, and of course, as all of us who have seen the speech,
but let me interrupt. He didn't. He never said that. Nixon said, "What does Eisenhower want?" And he wouldn't say. He said, "Well, I would say the people, Eisenhower's advisors have come to the conclusion." And Nixon knew, of course, very well. And the Herald Tribune, which was like the magnetic pole of Republicanism, had suggested that he ought to offer his resignation, which also, and one of Eisenhower's friends was the publisher of the Herald Tribune. So Nixon had reason to be suspicious. I'm just sorry. About how
okay.
I felt.
But at that point, as you wrote in the book, it wasn't just Nixon. Even Pat felt that they were being abused.
Yeah.
Okay. So my question is, As we all know, at the end of the speech, what Nixon says is, everybody's wondering whether I'm going to resign or not, and tonight I'm asked, or maybe he didn't use his word, whether I'm going to be off the ticket or on the ticket.
He never said that. That's the thing. In his notes, actually, there's a phrase that...
He says something to the effect about what's my future, right? And he says, I'm leaving the decision to Governor, or to General
Eisenhower, Republican National Committee,
the decision which is his to make, but I'm asking people to call him, telephone him, send telegrams and the like. And essentially what he did was he was leveraging public support to force the general to make a decision. He was not resigning.
That's absolutely true. He actually was actually going around. He didn't say right to the general. He said right to the Republican National Committee. That was infuriated Eisenhower.
And as you note in the book, the switchboard lit up.
Yes.
Literally overnight, forcing Eisenhower's hand on this.
Very much so, yeah.
So my question, in your research on this, what did you come across in terms of Nixon's inspiration for this move? Was that something he thought of during the speech? Was it something he planned before the speech? What was the inspiration?
It's a good question. I mean, it's clearly something he planned. Nixon was a very bright guy, and Nixon really knew how to play politics and how to play tough politics, and it was clearly... He clearly was not going to end the speech saying, of course, this is up to General Eisenhower. He was not going to do that. So, no, that was totally Nixon, and he clearly must have thought it through. I can't find any, I couldn't find any notes of anything saying that he thought it through or he had this planned out, but he clearly knew what was going on. He was a bright guy, and Nixon knew how politics is played. He knew the presidents choose vice presidents or they get rid of them. At one point, a friend of his, William Rogers, who later became his attorney general when he was president, had told him, you know, Dick, if the general wants you to resign, you've got to go. And Nixon didn't want to set up a situation in which Eisenhower would tell him directly he should go, because in any case he would go. But he knew he had sort of scoped out Eisenhower, and Eisenhower wasn't going to do it. Eisenhower was going to say, you're done for. He could have advisors say, we think the president thinks you ought to leave, or there's the opinion around the president but they couldn't do that final step. Ike wants you to go. Or Ike calling Nixon and saying, I want you off the ticket. That never would happen.
We've spent some time so far focusing on former President Nixon and then Vice President Nixon. Yeah. A couple questions from our audience about General Eisenhower, then President Eisenhower.
Sure.
A first question, given his military background, could Eisenhower have been elected with another person serving as vice president?
Absolutely.
I think what the question is about is, did Eisenhower possess the domestic political skills to get elected? Because clearly that's what I think this is what they're asking. Nixon brought that to the table.
Yeah, it had no effect at all. Eisenhower could have just sort of said, "I'm in," and he would have won. He would have won by acclamation. I think he was so beloved. He was so popular. And in fact, I mentioned very briefly that Harold Stassen, who was in the had a non-official cabinet post, was trying to lobby to replace Nixon with Governor Herter of Massachusetts, and he actually produced a poll which showed that Eisenhower would run 5 points ahead with Herter than he would run with Nixon. Nixon was not very popular, and in one of Ike's conversations with Nixon when he was telling him to take another job, he said, you know, we have these polls that showed Nixon losing in a theoretical race against Adlai Stevenson. So no, Eisenhower was. But that's how Eisenhower would treat Nixon too. He said, Dick, you're not very popular. You know, well, you got to do something to sort of build yourself up and so on. But no, he would definitely have won. He could have won running with checkers. He would have won.
All right, I'm going to tag on my own question as a follow up to that. Then I want to tease out a different answer out of you. Did Nixon's presence and Nixon's experience in Congress and his youth and energy and like make Eisenhower better at governance once he was in office in that first term?
I think Nixon was very helpful in all these little. For example, the whole civil rights issue. Eisenhower hated the Brown versus Board of Education decision, on the other hand, Eisenhower was a great believer in the Constitution, and so he understood that when he needed to enforce the Constitution, as in Little Rock, he did the right thing. He told a friend of his, this is what I've been fearing when Little Rock happened. This is what I've been fearing all along. It's the most disruptive thing that could happen. And Nixon, had genuine feelings about equal rights. Martin Luther King was told friends, well, you know, he was raised a Quaker, and I think he really was raised without prejudice. I think he had prejudices, but I think with the prejudices that he did, that were never made public, and I think he really, really did dirty the belief in it. His nastiest campaign was 1956, and 54, I'm sorry, and he was And he made one stop in Wilmington, Delaware, where they were having real problems with school integration, and someone asked him about it. And he suddenly just spontaneously started talking. He's saying 600 million people in the world are not white, and they're going to look to us, and if they don't see that we're treating our citizens equally and fairly, they're not going to support us. And it happened to be a New York Times reporter there named Peter Keese who wrote about it and wrote to Nixon how impressed he was. So there was that side of him. And Nixon was also very helpful simply in the administration. He was there. I talked to someone who sat in on cabinet meetings, and Nixon was like the man who was the great synthesizer. He could sum up what was going on, and he was also helpful in terms of pushing Eisenhower to do the right thing and things like. Eisenhower didn't get the space program. He didn't get why this was a matter of national destiny and national reputation. Nixon got it right away. So I think there might not have been a civilian NASA, or at least not so quickly, if Nixon hadn't been in the cabinet. In the administration.
On that score, another question from one of our listeners. You addressed some of this before, but I think it's asking a slightly different question. Getting at the source or the core of the adulation and popularity for Eisenhower coming out of World War II. Was that primarily just about his military success, or was the public aware of more about his background?
No,
was he a flash in the pan?
No. It was all of it. I mean, it was. Try to imagine Charles Lindbergh without Charles Lindbergh, so to speak. I mean, he had the great smile. He looked great. He was a child of the Midwest with his extraordinary grin. And he was a genuine. I mean, his feelings, his instincts about international, about America's role in the world were very progressive, and that's why the Easterners loved him. That's why the New Herald Tribune loved him, and so on. No, he was no flash in the pan, and he was very bright. The sort of bumbling thing that people began to see about 30 years ago, began to understand. Look at these letters. Look at these papers. Look at these memos. This is a smart guy, and as he was. No. Nixon. I mean, Eisenhower was. But it was also the fact of being a hero, a national hero, in a state of a kind that we simply don't have anymore. I can't think of anyone like him today. I mean, and when he left office, his approval rating was probably in the 70s. It just didn't change.
In that vein, just staying with, I'll just tack on a question for myself.
Sure.
Do you think we'll ever see? Another generals moving into politics this way. We had General Petraeus recently. There was Norman Schwarzkopf a long time ago. People remembered.
Well, don't forget General Haig and Wesley
Haig,
Clark.
Of course.
More candidacies that lasted 14 seconds and so on. No, you have first place. I mean, it was the war itself, which was a grinding war that ended in triumph for us.
But also a war for which there is public support.
Yes.
Yeah.
And which never went away. I mean, so you can't quite imagine a Vietnam general ever having that kind of popularity, even if Vietnam had been as successful. And certainly there was no Korean general, though Douglas MacArthur was eager to be crowned at one point. And he was, in the book I quote, he was becoming sort of increasingly, from my standpoint, increasingly batty toward the end of his career. I mean, he was planning. I mean, he was offering his way to finally win the Korean War was to drop nuclear bombs all over the place and destroy the Chinese infrastructure. It was long and kind of scary memos that never got acted on, thank God, and so on.
Well, so on that score, being president is the question from one of the audience members. Being president is an executive office, serving an executive office. Does being a general come with the same skill sets?
Not at all. Therefore, Eisenhower was. I mean, I think what made Eisenhower so suited for the thing was that he really did have respect for civilian control, and he really did have respect for the Constitution, and he really did want to play by the rules. And yet, what made him less good about certain domestic questions was he didn't really understand his own country. Therefore, he wasn't really great on civil rights. He wasn't great on sort of lots of things. Nixon was sort of very big on sort of catastrophic health care, for example. Actually, so was Robert Taft, the conservative Republican. And Eisenhower, it wasn't something that he would even think about. He'd been in the Army. His health care was taken care of all his life. His housing was taken care of all his life. You know, so they had sort of very different experiences.
Just to tease again something out, is that because Eisenhower was abroad so much? You said he didn't
understand
politics.
I think just simply being in the Army, but it was being abroad and being in that war which made him such a large figure, which made it possible to consider him for the presidency. But I think just simply being in the Army, being a lifer in the Army, I think does shield you from from the realities of life that most people feel. I mean, you have your job, you have your food, you have your housing, you have your medical care. It's pretty, apart from the fact that can be a very dangerous and important job, but you have those other things that are taken care of for you. So that was Eisenhower's experience. When he got out of office, he didn't know how to do much. They had rotary telephones, and someone, I think it was Steve Ambrose, said, you know, would someone show me how to run this goddamn phone? He didn't know how to call anyone. He didn't know about tolls on the turnpike. He didn't understand frozen orange juice. You know, these men, I mean, he had a valet, Sergeant Mone. So no, it was Nixon never had a valet.
One more question on Eisenhower from one of our audience members.
Sure.
You covered this briefly in the talk, and you addressed this in the book as well, I recall. Eisenhower's heart problem.
Yeah.
In your opinion, how close was Nixon to assuming power for the presidency then?
Well, that's a medical opinion. I think for a couple of days it was really close, and then no. And then Nixon's hope was that not only that Eisenhower recover after a sort of cut, but that Eisenhower would run again, because if Eisenhower had not run again in 56, then everything would have been up for grabs once more. I mean, Nixon would have had to run for office, and it was not clear he would have ever gotten Eisenhower's approval that early, and certainly no one else, no other nominee would ever have chosen Nixon to run with him. So there was,
he would have been 41 then. Yeah?
Would have been 40. He was 39 in 52. So he was 43 in 56. Yeah.
Pretty young.
Yeah, pretty young.
Yeah, interesting.
I guess that was the same age that Kennedy was when he won in 60.
Yeah. Let's move back to their relationship, if we could. This some of our audience members. Can you offer an opinion about ways that either Dick Nixon, Richard Nixon, or General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, changed the other for the better?
Yeah, I mean, I think Nixon became a sort of more organized person. I think he really tried. I think Eisenhower, I'm not sure how many of these lessons took, but just simply patience. He would have had a temptation to sort of fly off the handle, cliche. And Eisenhower, I think, helped him particularly in foreign affairs. And Eisenhower, I think helped him that way. And I think on the other side, I think just watching Nixon at work, I think he sort of gave Eisenhower some political lessons, just sort of observing him. For example, and even John Foster Dulles, when John Foster Dulles went to a conference in Geneva, Nixon would say, "Be careful who you take with you. You don't want to have too many. You don't want to have people thinking that other people are getting closer to the president than you are." Nixon was very, very good at office politics. Eisenhower didn't really need much of that, but I think Nixon really helped him. I'm not sure he learned anything from Nixon that way, but he was helped by Nixon on issues like the space program, and some of our defense issues. Nixon was a bit more hawkish than Eisenhower, which Eisenhower hated,
In that capacity, I'm now paraphrasing a couple questions that are asking the same thing. You mentioned in the talk today and in the book, you write about the fact that gradually Eisenhower began to give him more responsibility, which included a lot of trips abroad.
Yeah.
Now, question is, given a statement you made just a while ago, which was that part of the reason Eisenhower didn't know much about domestic politics is that he was always stationed somewhere else, why would he not himself have traveled abroad more as president?
He did travel some abroad. He went to all the major conferences and so on. And he knew. Think about Eisenhower. You mustn't forget that Eisenhower knew everybody. I mean, during the war, he had Churchill, De Gaulle. I mean, he really was a man. He was so well prepared for that job. And Nixon always said the real job of the presidency is international affairs. And Eisenhower just stepped into it. So he didn't really need to travel. People traveled to him. But he did travel. And of course, there was a famous moment when a peace conference in Paris fell apart because of overflights of Russia, the U-2 things. Khrushchev had come here in 59. Eisenhower was going to have a visit to Paris in 60. That never happened. No, Eisenhower did traveled some, and he had basically an around the world peace trip just at the end of his presidency. He was sort of acclaimed everywhere he went.
Okay. One more on the partnership. Another of our audience members writes, "We've talked about how they affected each other and the like. This is an interesting question. What were, if any, Nixon and Eisenhower's major political disagreements?"
I mean, I mentioned civil rights was not a disagreement. They just had different attitudes. I think the big one was on Indochina, and that's where you really saw it. In 1954, the French were about to be driven out of Indochina. There was the famous Battle of Dien Bien Phu, where it was all over. And Eisenhower had tried to support the French, but he actually helped pay for some of their war, and he sent them weapons. But they wanted more. They wanted airstrikes and they wanted real help. They were talking to our Joint Chiefs of Staff. A man named Admiral Radford had a plan to sort of send in three nuclear weapons to help the French against the Viet Minh, and that happened. Nixon was one of those who wanted to intervene militarily to help the French, and he actually made a speech to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, opening the possibility that ground troops would be sent in, and then really all kinds of problems sort of broke out. Then everyone got, I mean, some Democratic senators over Mr. Nixon's war. Eisenhower did not want to have another war in Southeast Asia. He had ended the war in Korea 6 months after taking office, and in a way that probably only Eisenhower could have done. He was General Eisenhower, the man who led the Allied forces. If Eisenhower said this was an unsupportable, unwinnable war, that was it. And the war ended. The war ended by a ceasefire, and then it was over. And Nixon really wanted to intervene. Eisenhower, there's a wonderful book by a woman named Melanie Billings Young, who's called Decision Against War, and it showed Eisenhower plotting against his own administration to keep us out of the thing. He would make suggestions, well, why don't we talk to Congress about it, knowing that Congress would never want to have anything to do with an Asian war. And he said, we must consult with our allies, knowing that Winston Churchill would never want to help the French Empire survive when the British Empire had fallen apart. And all these things, nothing, of course, knowing nothing would ever happen. And that was Eisenhower's approach. But very Eisenhower-like, never to do it directly. And yet, there was no, as you know, there was no intervention in Southeast Asia in what is now Vietnam until later.
So again, I want to follow up and just tease out a different answer out of you. Sure. Is it your sense, as a biographer now, of these two people, that we've talked before that Nixon carried from his days in the Senate race and the House race the anti-red fervor, yeah, which was clearly politically popular at the time, the Soviet/communist menace that replaced the Nazi menace after World War II, this, yeah, became the other for us as well. And that seemed to be something he used, certainly, even in the Checker speech and into the administration as a campaign tactic. You shared with me before that Nixon was a cold warrior, maybe even to the end of his presidency later. He had some of those roots. Question, did Eisenhower, having been at the front, mm-hmm, in a different capacity, share that in your perspective?
Some of it. By the way, I don't want to go, I don't want to call Marco Rubio on you, but let me just have one more.
Yeah. Stay on your mark within the camera frame. That's right.
No, Eisenhower introduced the term, the domino theory was Eisenhower. No, Eisenhower was, it's just that Eisenhower didn't have that sort of fervor that Nixon had about it. No, he took the communist threat very seriously. He didn't want to see more countries sort of going communist, but he also was, I think, enough of a realist to know what could be done and what couldn't be done.
Do you think he saw the threat domestically the way that Nixon had portrayed it?
No, not at all.
So that was a disagreement.
He thought it was completely preposterous. And he was also, he hated Senator McCarthy. He just hated him. And he said, I'm not going to get down to the gutter with that guy. McCarthy had done a number of terrible things. McCarthy had, and actually it was one of Eisenhower's most cowardly moments. McCarthy had attacked General Marshall, who was Eisenhower's mentor, who'd done more for him than anybody, helped his career, and he gave a speech on the floor of the Senate, calling that Marshall was the heart of a dark conspiracy to undermine our liberties, and basically accused him of being a communist, insane. And when Eisenhower had a chance to sort of take him down during the campaign, and he never did. And Marshall's wife told a columnist, you know, George always listened and expected Eisenhower to say something and never did, and so on. No. But he hated McCarthy, and as McCarthy became sort of more McCarthy-like, so he's thinking, he ordered Nixon to take him on, and Nixon did. Nixon hated doing it because they shared the same base, but Nixon did his duty. It was an interesting speech. I don't want to go on about it unless you want to hear
more. But Jeff, I'm curious about this. And you've done a lot of research. In the research, did you ever find instances where the president actually tried to rein Nixon in on the domestic?
Well, sure. There was a, there, yeah. There was one. Yeah. In Often, or not sometimes. Nixon's rhetoric would get out of hand, and he would say, there was one where he spoke about how the Democrats had given up. They had basically lost China and so on. And he went after Dean Acheson, and Eisenhower called him in and said, "Listen, Dick, we really don't want to be calling out. You know, this is a bipartisan thing at the time. You know, he didn't even have to say that George Marshall had actually preceded Dean Acheson, Secretary of State. So there was he basically knock it off. And actually, in that campaign, Nixon never mentioned Acheson's name again. Eisenhower could, but also again, Eisenhower being Eisenhower, even if he was really appalled by Nixon, some of Nixon's language, he could see it helping him sometimes. So he was very sort of rein it in. But then when he did it again, he didn't scold him again. But he definitely was embarrassed by some of it, and McCarthy particularly, and he really wanted to get rid of McCarthy. And Nixon understood that, and Nixon himself understood how bad McCarthy was for the party and for himself. He turned to I have some notes by one of his aides or a basically Nixon said, "I think it's time to dump the guy." Talking about McCarthy, and actually it happened pretty soon after that.
Very interesting. Let me turn us now to talk about a young Richard Nixon, if we could. There's several questions about that. One question from one of our audience members: did your research turn up any insight into Nixon's defeat of Jerry Voorhees in his early political career?
Yeah, I mean that was really the start, and Nixon instinctively knew how to sort of go for the throat, and he did with Jerry Voorhees. He was a good debater, and he didn't play completely fair. He got Voorhees into a series of debates, and his most devastating comment was that, I guess, one political action committee that supported Voorhees, he said it was sort of infested by communists and other things. And so Nixon, but the thing that really helped Nixon against Voorhees had nothing to do with the red issue or anything else. It had to do with the Los Angeles Times. And the Los Angeles Times then was not only the dominant paper in that region in SoCal, but it was but the man who ran the political coverage was a man named Kyle Palmer, who was a very interesting figure. And he had told some New York Times writer, "We don't go for all that crap about one side and then the other side." He ran the news side. He was in charge of the editorial page, and he also wrote a column called The Watchman, all of which were devoted to helping Richard Nixon. He was in love with, in a completely sort of man crush kind of way. He loved Richard Nixon. He really saw him as a sort of great coming future politician, and that, I think, that more than anything else pushed Nixon over the top in 1946, his first race.
On that same vein, before we came out, you and I were having a conversation about how history is filled with what ifs.
Yeah.
And
I love counterfactual history.
So we were talking about the fact that it's not commonly known that Nixon was actually admitted to Harvard with a scholarship. Would you expand on that and talk about how you think things might have been different?
Nixon, it's true. Nixon, when he finished Whittier High, had a scholarship to Harvard. And they simply couldn't afford it. The Nixon family couldn't afford it. There were illnesses in the family. They had medical. You know, his older brother was dying of tuberculosis, and he would live a couple of years. So they couldn't afford it. And I've always wondered what would have happened. You know, what would have happened to Richard Nixon if he'd gone to Harvard? It's such an interesting thing to think about. All of his resentment of the Eastern establishment wouldn't have been there. Alger Hiss drove him crazy because of that sort of snooty air that Hiss had. I think that was probably as responsible for Hiss's downfall as the fact that he was probably passing documents to the Russians. And it's just an interesting thing. He would have gotten a job at Sullivan and Cromwell, which of course didn't even look at his application when he graduated from Whittier College in Duke. And it just fascinates me the what ifs in history and in people's lives. And this, Nixon had many such, by the way, many such turning points in his life. And you always have lots of what ifs. I have some other favorites if you want to, but later on.
Okay. Yeah. Let's move Nixon and Eisenhower to a later period in their life. Of course, they actually became in-laws.
They did.
Later in life.
In-laws once removed.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So what a strange marriage again. Yeah. So that was a bad pun. Here is the question from one of the audience members: how did the marriage of Nixon's daughter and Eisenhower's was it son or grandson? I forgot.
Grandson.
Change their relationship, or did it?
You mean change Eisenhower-Nixon's relationship?
Eisenhower-Nixon's relationship.
Yeah, it definitely changed it. I mean, you should realize that when David Eisenhower and Julie Nixon began dating, and they actually began falling madly in love with each other, they were 18 years old. They were 19 years old when they announced their engagement to their families, and which Eisenhower didn't like, because he didn't like Julie, but because he thought David was going to sabotage David's career as a lawyer or a doctor or whatever. And then they got married a month after Nixon was elected president in 68. They were 20 years old. And I think the real difference it made in their relationship was Julie. People like Julie. Julie is sort of a bubbly. I mean, she's been through hell with all this stuff, with the scandals and so on. But she sort of keeps her sort of cheery self going. And the Eisenhowers just really liked her. And someone in the family told me, I'm not sure it was off the record now, so I better be careful. But told me that they began to look differently at Nixon after busting by knowing Julie. How could anyone who produced a daughter like that be bad? So they began to see Nixon in a sort of friendlier light. So even if they hadn't really liked him much, they liked him more because of Julie. And well, you know that Julie in 2008 worked for the election of Barack Obama, which is along with her sister-in-law Susan.
Everybody else in the country too.
Yeah, right. I think David probably worked for McCain, but that would have been a Navy thing.
Let's come full circle now to the present. A very good question from one of our audience members. Given on what you saw in the relationship between Eisenhower and Nixon in the 1950s, do you see any parallels today to that kind of relationship? I assume the questioner was asking about at the presidential level, but maybe we can see another aspect.
I thought a lot about that. That theme of total inequality between a president and vice president. I mean, you look at Biden and Obama. I mean, Biden is actually the more experienced one and the older one. They're both senators. Bush-Quayle, I mean, that was an inequality, but not due to rank. It was due to other qualities. No, there's nothing. Nothing quite like that. And the other thing that made this thing so different, I think, was that it never ended. Most presidents and vice presidents, it's over. I can't think of. Even Clinton and Gore basically had a falling out. That was the end of that. I don't think Reagan and Bush ever saw each other. They didn't like each other very much. But Nixon and Eisenhower grew closer, and this thing went on for 17 years. I talked about the first meeting at the Bohemian Grove in 1950, and it didn't end until Eisenhower died in March of '69. And they became closer in a funny way. I mean, they were friends, but when Eisenhower in his post presidency he moved out to the Coachella Valley, he actually had a house on a fairway at the El Dorado Country Club because I could love golf and so on. And Nicky said, "Come on out, Dick, let's play golf together." There was a whole different relationship that began to unfold. And he was probably the person who most influential in getting Nixon to run for governor of California, which was a terrible mistake. But Eisenhower at least had the decency to come out and campaign very hard for him and say really nice things about him. I can't think of any relationship like that that went on and didn't end after their official time together ended. And then of course the family tie only made it closer.
Thank you. By the way, for our radio audience, I need to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Radio Program, and our guest today is noted journalist and author Jeffrey Frank, who's discussing his new book about the unusual relationship, don't take that the wrong way, between Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon. If I could, Jeff, just one more question. We'll just stay on this, sort of staying in the present tense, in the present politically. This from another one of our audience members. Interesting question. Is there much to be said for the Eisenhower-Obama comparison, a reason for the president's interest and specifically Eisenhower's presidency?
It's funny you ask that. Almost from the start of the Obama administration, I began to sort of sense certain parallels. I mean, of course, their background couldn't be less alike. But the one quality that I see they both had is this quality of patience and judiciousness. Watching Obama sort of basically trying to get us out of these two wars is very Eisenhowerian to me. I mean, he can't say it. He can't say they're unwinnable, unsustainable. But it's clear that he believes this in a way that. And that was Eisenhower in Korea, and he had, it's this patience and it's this quality of judiciousness which probably trumps everything else when you're a president. And Eisenhower had it. Eisenhower of course had it too, I think.
Two more questions. We have 4 minutes left. I'll try and get to the last couple questions.
Sure.
One last time back to Checkers, the speech. The mother of all mea culpa speeches, right? A false mea culpa. Given the last 50 or 60 years of politicians getting into trouble and thinking of ways to either get in front of a problem or have to explain it after it happens, what is the historical significance today of checkers?
Well, you have to remember that Nixon really hadn't done anything wrong. That's one of the big differences.
But the perception was that
the perception. Well, yeah, but
that's all that matters in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't a universal perception, but I think getting out. It's a combination of getting out in front, trying to be as honest about the problem as possible, and then really not having done anything wrong. I mean, what he had done was. Their bookkeeping was really good. They really could account for everything. 50 accountants from what Price Waterhouse went through all the books. They found nothing untoward, and the amount of money involved was $18,000. So Nixon didn't have that much to apologize for to begin with because he did it in a way that's still a classic. That speech, you should all watch that speech. It's on YouTube. It still holds up. It's just a bit of theater today. There's nothing like it. And it's quite amazing. And when you realize, you look at this guy, he's a 39-year-old guy, and his whole life is on the line, his whole career is on the line, and he had a face, and he knew that the former Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces wanted him gone, and he went in there and did it. And no matter how much you dislike him, and he's not a likable guy, you got to say, that really took guts, didn't it? And it's kind of fascinating to watch it.
Okay. Then, on that note, a final question in the last couple minutes, and I want you to maybe expound on this. It has been obviously several decades since Nixon was president in this country. I'm looking out at the audience, and I think most of us, if not all of us, who were alive during his presidency probably formed opinions about him. Some of them, as you, probably most of us, with opinions that were not positive, given what happened with Watergate. But we are in that period where you're far enough removed now from his death as well that people will begin to take a larger look at his life. And your book is part of that process. Yeah. So how do you think history as we go forward will review the life of this person? And do you think that the negativity from Watergate will recede and be part of a larger context, or will that still dominate things?
I think Bill Clinton at his funeral said the time will come when we don't judge a man whole career by one incident, and he was definitely referring to Watergate. I think the further we recede...
I thought he was referring to himself.
I think, that's a very good point. But anyway, I think the further we recede, it's almost like a camera. You get the longer and longer view as you recede away from an event or from a picture, and I think it's probably going to happen. We'll see the good and the bad of Nixon. I was a Nixon hater when I was young. I mean, he was you looked at him and said, oh God. But you begin say the further away you get from him, and you begin he's a deeply human being, and you find yourself seeing him. And I saw him as a great. My novelist side, and by the way, there's nothing. I mean, this is my journalist historical side was all that went into this book. But my novelist side just saw him as a great character, a fascinating character, and I really tried. I wanted to understand him as a person. I don't know that I did or not, but people who knew him actually think I've come close in some ways. I hope I have.
Okay. Well, our special thanks to Jeffrey Frank, former senior editor of The New Yorker, author of lots of books, including novels I recommend to you, and also the author of a new book, which you've been talking about today, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. I've read it. I recommend it. Go out and buy it. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program, of course, has been part of the club's Good Lit series, I think they mean literature, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation, the foundation we thank. We want to remind everyone here that copies of Mr. Frank's new book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign them in the room following the program. And for now, I'm Joe Tooman, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.
Very good. Is it okay?